remember last time, we considered this question of power, and we saw that power is invariably misused unless there has been the right basis prepared beforehand, namely the harmony of perfect love and wisdom. And it's a basis that oneself, the individual, cannot prepare positively. I cannot say to myself, I will now lay the basis, the foundation for love. I'll lay the foundation for wisdom in any positive sense. All I can do is to be so mindful, to so awake that the obstructions to love and power disappear. Because this love, to love and wisdom disappear. Because this love, this wisdom, is something which we simply do not know and never can know in its own inner essential reality. We can see afterwards, after love and wisdom have come to fruition and flowered and produce, give rise to certain events and phenomena in the world, it is only afterwards that we can see that yes, this is the result of love and wisdom. And when a person's life and being is so in harmony with that state where such love and wisdom inevitably flows through, then that person can rightly use power. And here again, he doesn't know it. He doesn't think it out. He is able to allow it to happen because there are no obstructions. And this is essentially one of the profound significances and expressions of the truly religious life. So power, without the right basis, inevitably leads to domination, to oppression, which means also, therefore, separation. I, the dominator, you, the dominated. It leads to exploitation. It leads to false relationships. It leads to the relationship between one image and another image. The whole reality is so utterly spontaneous. It is so utterly free, so completely whole, holy. It is our minds, immature, ignorant, incapable, which inject the poison into that situation of perfection. Come in. That situation of perfection is really the meaning of Eden. The bliss of Eden. It is also the meaning of that which is present with the realization of Nirvana, with the entry into the kingdom of heaven. When I am unselfed, then power is continuous creation. It is no longer domination. This is the only way that power can be rightly expressed. It is the divine way, if you like. God the Creator, always. The first description of God in any religion is God the Creator. It is because man's immature, ignorant mind produced concepts of God the Creator and spoilt the reality of God the Creator, that the Buddha left it out completely. And he showed that all the concepts as such were false concepts. Now, this business of power is extremely important in our lives. There is not a single activity of the body, or of speech, or of thought and feeling, which can take place without using power, energy. Any manifestation is the manifestation of energy. It has to be. If there is no energy, there is the stillness, not of holiness or perfection, but the stillness of the grave. You see? So, we have to understand power very deeply. Power or energy utilized by us. There is only one way to understand it. That is to be free of all grasping for power. Be completely free of all grasping for power. And if we can do that, we will find that we are also free from the limited ego-circumscribed self-conception. This is what I mean when I say when a person is unselfed. The psychophysical organism, of course, is there as an undeniable fact. And it is not the same psychophysical organism as anybody, as any other psychophysical organism. And it is convenient to refer to each such organism as a self. If you and I are talking together, we refer to ourselves as I, respectively, and to the person to whom we are talking as you. It's a convenient technique. But if and when my awareness is blinded to such an extent that I cannot see the living relationships, the continuous and unbreakable relationships which exist in actual fact between you and me, then this separative self-consciousness steps in and spoils the entire situation. But when I am free of that separative self-consciousness, then I am unselfed. You remember, I have mentioned again and again those wonderful words out of the Tejobindu Upanishad. Shiva, the great God, says, I am the I that has given up I. Nevertheless, I am the I, the true I, the pure I, which has given up I. And since God the Creator creates everything out of His own being, therefore I, God, am the totality. Of course, your strict, conventional theist would throw up his hands in horror at this. This is pantheism. It doesn't strike him that perhaps what he labels pantheism is the fact of existence. That's that. You and I, as bodies, are made up of atoms of chemical elements which are of the universal stuff. A pan-materialist doctrine. But nobody fights shy of that or throws up his hands in horror and say, oh, that's pan-materialism. What is there to throw up one's hands in horror at pantheism? Nothing at all. It's just that I am ignorant, somewhat afraid, somewhat desirous of perpetuating the separation. And that is all there is to it. Otherwise, it's the fact. We cannot talk of the unity of life, of one total reality, and at the same time separate or cause separation to appear in what is one total unity. Now, I want to relate this idea of power to our spiritual life and so forth. You know that through that great rhythm of history, which has lasted 4,000 years and more, the hierarchical idea has held a dominant position. Here is God. Here are the archangels. Here are the angels who obey His commands and so forth. In our human sphere, here is the Master, the Adept, the Perfected Holy One. Here are His disciples who follow in the footsteps of the Master and so forth. And various techniques are laid down for the disciples to become like the Master. Whichever master lays down a technique which will make the disciple like him is an exploiter, is a dominator. This mysterious transcendent power, of which the entire universe is an expression, made everything or releases into manifestation everything as a unique thing in itself. That's its beauty. The beauty of the thing, the person, the living creature, the plant, and also the beauty of this wonderful power, this universal mysterious power. For any one thing to presume to make another thing in his image is the attempt to destroy that thing. The true teacher is the servant. Frank isn't here. None of you were present at the very first meeting of this Saturday group. in February 1962. And I expressly mentioned, you must regard me as your servant, not as a teacher here. Not as somebody who will show you a way which you must follow and become thus, thus, and thus, according to my picture. This is domination, this is evil. In such a situation, there is no love. I know the question which will immediately rise up in the minds of so many devoted followers of the different faiths. But surely, the Buddha laid down a path, laid down a way for the bhikkhus. Jesus laid down a way for his apostles, and so forth. But consider carefully just what actually happened. When the Buddha taught, he said what he had to say. Because he was so supremely perceptive, he knew the person whom he was talking to at once, just like that, just to meet him, and he knew him. And he threw out suggestions to that person. Thus and thus, you will find this helpful. And afterwards, if the person really saw the light, he said he was anxious to work upon it, to fulfill it. If he didn't see the light, he said, thank you very much, I am busy now, I have such and such a thing to do. And the Buddha would say, goodbye, do what you think fit. And they parted on excellent terms always. And the Buddha also said, whatsoever can be done out of compassion has been done by me for you. And then he adds, do not miss your opportunities. Do not let yourselves be filled with remorse afterwards. Here are trees. Here are the roots of trees. Meditate. Now, what happens when the bhikkhu meditates? What happens when the apostle prays in silence to his Father God? There is the flowering out from within of that unique being, that unique person who is there. And the flowering out is not the fulfillment or glory of that particular separate person as a person, but it is the fulfillment of totality. Unto God be the glory, as it is put in the theistic religions. So, we talk loosely, ignorantly, in terms of the teachers laid down a way which the disciples must follow. What has happened in consequence? With the death of the teachers and the passing away of those who in his presence, in that loving communion with him, the living teacher, when that was over and the decades and centuries passed, ignorant people came along and laid down bondages. Spread the gospel, as they called it. Established movements. laid down rules and regulations in order that the movement, that the society, the external husk may continue. Meanwhile, the squirrel had run away with the nut and left the outer husk. That is what happens. Now, of these techniques, one technique which is employed is known as, in India, as japa, the repetition of the holy word, the mantra, the magical spell. Now, you know that when the Aryan-speaking people brought the Rig Veda with them, the oldest religious monument of our Indo-European race, into India, they also brought with them a great ritualistic system, a ceremonial magic. And in that ceremonial magic, the intoned, the musically intoned words of the Rig Veda produced effects. Now we forget that any harmonious expression, whether it be in color or sound or shape, whatever it may be, produces a very great effect upon the psyche of the participant, of the congregation. As long as the congregation was intelligent, was devoted, was free of grasping for self, then that ceremonial magic had its effect. There again, as the centuries passed, all that was forgotten, and it became the mumble jumble that has survived through the millennia. I wonder if you have ever tried for yourselves saying a prayer quietly, audibly. You were all born in a Christian tradition. Take, for example, Our Father, which art in heaven. You see? And if it is intoned, and there is complete calm, balance within oneself, there is no grasping for the self, for the limited self, you will find an extraordinary effect. An effect which is not a mere passing phenomenon. It is a real power which can transform. Provided, as I say, you do not grasp for the self. Provided you do not preconceive how you shall be transformed. Provided also you know exactly what the words mean. Not meaningless sounds. You must know what the word means. Those who present mantras and say that, oh, all the better if you don't know the meaning of the thing. This is domination. This is the anesthetizing of the psyche. The lulling of the awareness so that you are caught with the song of the sirens. The word Our Father in the Christian prayer has its point of reference in what is called the wisdom of Yahweh. That is the Reshit, the point of beginning. And when I read that script for you, the meeting before last on Moses, you remember I mentioned the peak on which you stand is your point of transcendence. If and when that peak is in line, complete line, with what for convenience I may call the divine plane, then pronounce the word Abba, Father, and you are right in the very center, in non-discriminating awareness with that wisdom of God, where no separation has yet taken place between the knowing subject and the known object. These are not mere words. Your logician, your intellectual will be completely flummoxed by statements like this. He will say, this man's talking through his hat. He's a nice fellow, he's a little bit afflicted though. But they don't know. The man who has never eaten a perfect English apple has not the slightest idea of what an English apple is like. You have to eat it. You have to know it by being it. That is Our Father. That other aspect of the wisdom, which is called intelligence, in which there is this continual separation between subject and object and the continual bridging of the gap, is the source of creation, the creation into multitudinousness. You see, and this is the mother, the ever fecund mother. Ignorant scholars out of the mountainous heaps of their knowledge have spoken critically of phallic worship and all sorts of things like that. They just don't know what they are talking about. Now, similarly, you can use Sanskrit mantras, Pali mantras, you can use English mantras, provided you use them in the right way, and can use them in the right way. But the difficulty is this: whilst we are still in the not completely pure condition, it is impossible to avoid using mantras, using any sort of power, without grasping for self. It is always a grasping for self. Therefore, leave it alone. Let me read a little bit of what is written in the Shandilya Upanishad. Shandilya was one of the perfected ones, the holy ones. Is also mentioned in the Chandogya Upanishad. Shandilya questioned Atharvan. He asks the question, and the answer includes this statement. Japa is the practicing of the mantras into which one is duly initiated by his spiritual instructor, and which is not against the Vedas. When we say Vedas, we immediately think of books and what the books contain. But if you have gone beyond that stage and entered into the depths, the Vedas mean the living truth, the living wisdom. It is there all the time. Its expressions, its interpretations by us human beings are called truths, are called Vedas. But they are only expressions. That expression cannot be there unless the living reality underlies it. This is always the mystery, the unknown thing. Always remember that all knowledge points to, emerges from, and points to, and culminates in the unknown. It is knowing which is separation. It is knowing which threw us out of Eden. Being, because of the communion of the love that never begins or ends, that is different. That is wisdom. Also, so the practicing of the mantras into which one is duly initiated by his spiritual instructor and which is not against the Vedas. It is of two kinds, the spoken and the mental. The mental is associated with contemplation by the mind. And do remember that contemplation, in the real sense of the word, is that which culminates in communion. As Krishnamurti says, the observation where there is not the separation between the observer and the observed. That is the... He speaks precisely what the Upanishads have stated about samadhi. Samadhi is that state of communion wherein the separation between observer and observed has vanished, between meditator and meditated has vanished. There is only meditation, meaning the state of communion. This is the difficulty. Our words, meditation, communion, are always interpreted by our minds in terms of separation. I am communing with you, or I am communing with nature, or with God, or with whatever it is. Always an other thing. But that is the very negation of the meaning of the word communion at its depth, of samadhi. Samadhi, sang adhi. Adhi, the supreme sang togetherness, the one unity. Now, so the mental part of japa is associated with contemplation by the mind. So now think. Japa is the repetition of a word or a set of words. Om Mani Padme Hum. So many of you know that. Hari Om, Hari Om, Hari Om is another. And so on and so on. There are lots and lots of them. You see? The spoken is of two kinds. The loud and the low. The loud pronunciation gives the reward as stated in the books. The low one gives a reward 1,000 times. The loud one. The mental gives a reward 1 crore of times that. 1 crore is 10 million. 10 million times that. An unfortunate way of presenting it gives a reward. What he means to say is, leads to such and such a state. Produces a result. But note carefully. The loud pronunciation. Relate this to Jesus' words about praying, and when you pray to your Father, pray silently. Pray thus. Not like those people who yell their prayers out in the temple, prove how holy they are. See? It'll bring a return, yes. There perhaps reward is the right word. It will bring a reward, you see. And the low repeated one, the softly spoken one, affects oneself much more. For the simple reason that if you say something quietly and softly, you will find that your attention is becoming lighted up more and more, intensely lighted up. The intensity of attention grows. When you find, you may recall, in our childhood, sometimes when we found something which we were learning rather difficult, and if we lowered our voice and read it slowly and more slowly with a low voice, somehow it went in, we understood. At least this has been my experience. One understands it. See? So the use of the low voice produces a more effective result. But the mantra in the mind, the contemplation associated with contemplation, leads to the supreme flower. Why? Because if the separation between contemplator and the contemplated vanishes, the words also vanish with it. Now if we start the business by saying, I'll start with a loud repetition 10 times, you see, I'll count 1, 2, 3, 4, you see, and all the rest of it, low repetition 10 times, and I'll see the effect. Yes, that was about 4 times as good. I'll repeat it 100 times, you know, quite low like that. I'll get 400 times the effect, and if I repeat it at a quarter of the volume of sound, I might get 1600 times the effect. I'm getting on very nicely. I am getting on very nicely. Now the devil is having a very happy time, isn't he? Another convert for hell. You see how easy it is in the name of religion, of truth, of God, of the perfect, of the wonderful, to just slide into the mire. And unhappily, to keep wallowing in it. Mud tastes nice.
Well, don't forget, our match of the day today is at 11:15, just after the University
of. But be careful about it. Be careful. Because at the back of it all is this subtle serpent. Pluck that fruit. Eat it. It's nice. You'll enjoy it. You'll be happy. You'll be the king of the castle. You'll rule, you'll control. You will be like God.
I remind you again that tonight's match of the day features highlights of the games between Manchester
City and West. In India we have many, many stories. As you know, thousands of stories. One of them runs in this wise. There was a sage called Bali who performed wonderful austerities. And at last his power became so very great that all the gods in heaven were very concerned. They felt that their rulership and almost their very existence was threatened by this one who had developed such tremendous power. So they sent Vishnu to deal with him. And Vishnu came along in the guise of a wandering ascetic, tattered clothes, and looking emaciated and worn and miserable. And he saluted Bali in the proper fashion. And he said, could you just grant me a simple wish? And Bali said, ask whatever you like. And this emaciated ascetic said, may I just take 3 steps? And Bali was a bit surprised and said, of course you may take 3 steps. Do, please. Help yourself. Enjoy yourself. So this ascetic took the 1st step. It covered all earth. He took the 2nd step. It covered all heaven. And Bali knew at once what had happened. And he bowed to the ground and said, hear, O Lord Vishnu, the 3rd step. And Bali stamped him into the earth. Vishnu stamped him into the earth. And saved all creation. Don't regard it as the cruelty of the Lord against the individual. These are stories. You see? Wonderful stories, aren't they? But look, when Bali said, hear, O Lord, and laid his head on the ground before Vishnu, that was the ultimate fruition, the perfection of Bali, the liberation, the complete end of all separation of Bali and the one total transcendent reality. It was the end of that. And it was done with perfection. The infinite mercy, wisdom, loving kindness of Vishnu seals that liberation of Bali with death. Death, not the wages of sin in this case, but death, the consummator, the perfecter, the releaser into immortality. This is the deep significance of such stories. See, death is two-faced, isn't it? That which hurts, separates, kills, destroys, which makes us fear the unknown, the unfinished here, the destruction of our clinging to life and all the little things of life. That is one face of death. But that face of death is transformed into his other face when you or I understand and grasp at nothing. When we grasp at nothing, death and oneself are identical. We let go of everything without grasping it. Whereupon, the out-of-stepness of chronological time and psychological time is ended. And that means that in our awareness, we live immortally, here and now, every second of our life. That is the only realization of immortality there is for the individual, here and now. To live with that awareness. Remember, an awareness, not a thought, not a concept. That is just a pie in the sky, a cloud which shuts out the light of the sun. But this is life. Let go. Grasp at nothing. Be awake to it. So, this is how Vishnu sealed Bali's liberation with death, the consummator, the perfecter. Because that moment when Bali laid his head on the ground before Vishnu, the sin of power had vanished, absolutely out. Power ceased. It is another form of the sort of Lucifer story. It's like that, isn't it? So now. The key not to grasp not to hold fast and thereby prevent the rhythm of life of that which we try to hold fast. It is like the cat catching hold of the mouse and playing with the mouse. Our grasping does precisely that. It kills the mouse. Or perhaps it's a bird which the cat has got hold of. And it kills the bird. Possession, domination, pleasure. Therefore destruction, evil, death with the lurid face, the face of horror. And it all comes in grasping. Why do we struggle so passionately for what we call self-expression? And if we don't do it consciously, we do it unconsciously all the time. Note how we, amongst other things, one of the most obvious ways in which it expresses itself, we can't stop chattering. It is one of the most mischievous forms of expression, the separate self. Chatterers can never enter nirvana. Quite impossible. Because if I haven't learned to be silent here, I shall still be chattering in the grave. And when there is no true silence of the grave, which I can only develop into, grow into, realize whilst I'm alive, there is no nirvana. Nirvana is silence. The kingdom of heaven is silence. We put it in the form, the peace of God which passes understanding. But that's a lovely, austere, beautiful phrase. We don't realize that one of its implications, practical implications, is to remain silent, not to chatter. And as with the instruction about the use of mantras, the japa, not to chatter audibly, which is obvious, and not to chatter here in the mind silently. Watch that chatter. We all suffer, to use Beryl's excellent phrase, from verbal diarrhea.
I didn't originate it.
Well, wherever you got it from, I heard it first from you. Verbal diarrhea.
My mother used to say that to me. I can't
remember. You see? Now, this is a form of grasping, but we don't realize it. You look at the person who is constantly chattering you, chattering at you, he or she will be so insistent that he will catch hold of your arm, he will prevent you from getting on with your work, etc., and pour all that chatter down you, just like that. He forgets that the earth was beautiful in her rhythmic dance 5,000 million years before he was born. And all that chatter is merely his disturbing contribution to the rhythm of life. And what happened?
Buddha says he must be made silent, and he was turned into stone. That's right, 500 kalpas. He was the only one that could deal with monkey. I think we're like
a lovely story. Now, you may also recall, time and again I've said, you cannot acquire silence. You cannot cultivate silence, like we cultivate a plant in the garden. Just as you cannot acquire or cultivate virtue. Where our spiritual being is concerned, our spiritual life is concerned, what is positive, if we may use the word positive in that sphere, is the negative, in fact, of all that we are commonly acquainted with in our life here. It is the refraining from evil. It is the negation of everything that we know and do here, which allows that transcendent reality to function through us unhindered. Look, I know this, it is so natural for the mind to ask why, how. I'll give you an analogy. But before I give the analogy, first let me say this. Transcendence has that dimension or dimensions or those dimensions of being and consciousness which are completely outside our experience and ken. Completely outside.
I suppose we must try it.
Now I'll give you the analogy. You have a flat surface. Supposing you had the ideal surface, the geometrical conceived surface. It's only a length and a breadth. It has no depth whatsoever. And you take a solid object, let's say a cube, which has length, breadth, and depth. How are you going to pack that cube into the surface? You can't. I cannot cultivate transcendence, therefore, similarly, in this, which is the limited, the finite, the particular. Now, where the analogy mustn't be stretched too far, in fact it fails, is here. I, the living being, can unself, reduced to my nothingness, that transcendence is unhindered. It is not packed into the limited and the particular, but its dimension of being and consciousness is unobstructed by this limited particular dimension of being and consciousness, which is me, the separate individual. Do you get it? It is like that. So the process, if we may use the word process, is this process of negating, of not obstructing, of not hindering. It is like letting the light into the room by drawing the curtains. This is what we don't do. Why? Because analogically, we translate our everyday material life into, or try to translate it into that which transcends the material, everyday material life. And by the word material here, I'm including our thinking, feeling, everything. You see? This is what I do. Therefore, in my house, therefore, when I go into God's house, I shall do likewise. No. Cannot be done. And God can't intrude into my house except and unless my house is broken. The ridgepole split, the rafters broken. The ridgepole broken, the rafters split in the Dhammapada. You see, when I'm unselfed, when there is no me, there is only God. You see, this is the meaning of renunciation. This is the meaning of sacrifice, the making sacred. And so forth. Now, today, let us try a little experiment. Our life here in the world is a life in which there is relationship with things, with persons, with ideas. Relationship. We imagine out of our ignorance and out of our grasping nature, as well as our resentful side, we imagine that we are related to the things inside the house, say. I'm going to choose things in one's own home because they are with us constantly, or more constantly than things not in the home. The particular chairs which we use, the table, the carpet, etc. It's there all the time, so to say. So one would feel that one is familiar with it. Familiar, yes, but related? Feel it out. Are we really related to the things in our home? Do we really know the things that are in our home? Or do we imagine that we know them? Is it just a concept of them, a picture of them that we have in our minds? And when we say, I, of course, and related to the objects here. Do I know what I mean when I say I? Or is it again an image? Let's start with things today. You see? Just let the body be perfectly at ease. Comfortable. If it won't be at ease, don't compel it. Because that's another form of domination. You can stop right there. And now just let us hold before the mind's eye, say, just three objects in our own home with which we are most familiar. Just see them. Now, are we looking at them just analytically? Color, shape, massiveness, weight, its utility? Are we looking at those objects just like that? Maybe a typewriter, maybe a piano, or maybe the cooker, objects which we use quite a lot. They are the tools of our trade or our daily life existence. That's why I mentioned cooker. Now, how am I looking? Now take any one object, one which you most use, most familiar. How do I regard this object? As a tool for my pleasure, for my existence. Am I or am I not looking at it with a self-oriented outlook, wholly selfish? Perhaps I may appreciate it. How do I appreciate it? Aesthetically? This piano is a beautiful instrument, wonderfully made, produces lovely sounds. Aesthetically? But what sort of aesthetic quality? It gives me pleasure. It gives other people pleasure, which in turn gives me pleasure, feeds my ego. Or it may be just a screwdriver. But I'm a carpenter and I use the screwdriver more than anything else, let us say. How do I regard that screwdriver? Look carefully within oneself. Now, don't I see it just as an object, an inanimate object? Separate from me. Or if the aesthetic sense is strong, if there is a rapport between me and the tool I use, there is a relationship up to a point only.
BBC One. Now the Debbie Reynolds show.
But note the different elements at play in that relationship. Now, let us try and look at that same object without any grasping. Just look at the object. The thing in itself. Just keep looking at it. And let all analytical looking calm down. Calm out of existence, so to say. What's happening now as I look in this manner? My eye sees unpossessively, unravishingly.
Hi. Hi, Doc. What do you think of this again? Well, it depends on what it is.
I see the object in itself.
Jewel letter opener to see.
It is not inanimate, it is not dead in the commoner garden sense of those words. It comes alive. Its atoms and molecules. Its shape, its color, its beauty, its quietness. It is in communion with the rest of the silent room as a room.
Thank you.
And when I can see like that, I see with a pure seeing, not with an impure seeing.
Hey, you got $30, and I've got. Oh, oh my gosh, I forgot the car.
Now perhaps.
Young man!
I become aware of the real relationship between that object and myself. A relationship of perfect freedom, of perfect peace, no domination. I use it as a tool, a vehicle, an instrument, which means the expression of power, of course. But that power is pure. Because when I see the object that way, I am in the unharming state. And if I'm fortunate enough, I myself am in the truly harmless state. Fully awake in deep slumber.
You find that package. Come on and help me. No. You sit here and stand guard and tell me when she comes. If I don't find that package before she comes down.
Isn't there a peculiar blissfulness in such regarding with the eye of affection, as the Buddha said? Seeing with the eye of wisdom. In which no thought, no desire, no grasping casts any shadow upon the light of transcendence embodied in an object. Now I can reverence matter, what I call matter. And if I reverence matter, I can never misuse matter.
Thank you, Charlotte.
I can do no harm to myself, to my neighbor.
How about this weather? It's so hot and dry.
And I am free from grasping.
Oh, oh yes, it's a hot, dry fog.
Now, the value of that object has changed. It is not £1,700 for an A grand Steinway. It is not 22 and sixpence for this very good screwdriver. It is not 105 guineas for this settee from Liberty's. It's none of those things. It is priceless.
Just enough to see. My, what are these enormous cats? Cat. The big black cat going up the stairs. He's a big old cat. Oh, he must have just been passing through.
Let us just see.
All right. Oh, let me get you
whether we can.
Oh, thank you. Very nice.
Implement this little meditation in our everyday life.
What is that punch? Three parts whiskey, two parts arsenic, and the rest was just plain brown glass.
And if that object disappears or undergoes a breakdown, there is no loss, there is no sorrow. There is just complete understanding. There is no anxiety. There is the relationship which is everlastingly right and can never be lost. Our relationship to things. Therefore, things are no longer a bondage, no longer a source of anxiety. What begins as thought in the common sense of the word, concepts, percepts, ideas, in relation to things, objects, what begins as thought out of a meditation of this sort will become a permanent living reality which transcends all thought. You see, our word being is so restricted to the person we see before us and who bears a certain name. But this way, the awareness becomes infinite. Not bloated in size, but it becomes infinite in the sense that it becomes so unresisting that unitary total reality is the pure unitary total reality. When there are men and women in the world who live thus, inevitably forces will flow through them which will transform the world. Restore it to its original title, Eden.